It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station, broadcasting from Signal Hill here in Kodiak, where it's 53 degrees. Rain is said to be likely mainly between 1 p.m. and 4 p.m. today. Mostly cloudy skies, high near 55, southeast winds to 5. For tonight, just a chance of rain before 10 p.m., and a slight chance of rain after 4 a.m. Mostly cloudy skies, a low around 47. And for tomorrow, rain, mainly after 10 a.m. High near 53 tomorrow. South winds will increase to 20 miles per hour tomorrow afternoon and could gust as high as 30. Coming up on the Midday Report, you might mistake it for an ordinary Connex, but this box is bright on the inside and produces lettuces. Also, what might be the effect of not funding the state's power cost equalization program for rural residents? And an update on the Munson Creek fire near Chena Hot Springs. Those stories and more after NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Joe Biden says the U.S. plans to have all of its troops out of Afghanistan by August 31st, ending a 20-year war that began with the September 11th terrorist attacks. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports that while the American military's presence winds down, the Taliban are gaining territory in Afghanistan.
President Biden says it's highly unlikely that Afghanistan will ever be a unified country, but Afghan forces have the capacity to sustain the government in place. He also assured that U.S. support for the country will endure.
We will continue to provide civilian and humanitarian assistance, including speaking out for the rights of women and girls. I intend to maintain our diplomatic presence in Afghanistan, and we are coordinating closely with our international partners in order to continue to secure the international airport.
Biden says the withdrawal from Afghanistan is overdue, adding that he will not send another generation of Americans to war with no reasonable expectation of achieving a different outcome. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
A troubling development in this country's long battle against coronavirus. New cases and hospitalizations are going back up, and that's likely to also be true for deaths from COVID-19. So far, more than 600,000 lives in the U.S. have been lost to the disease since the start of the pandemic. Delta, now the dominant variant of coronavirus, is spreading, and it's doing so quickly in parts of the country where vaccination rates are low.
Please get vaccinated. It will protect you against the surging of the Delta variant.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's leading infectious disease expert, expressing exasperation over the low rate of vaccinations. He says that while everybody in the U.S. could get a COVID vaccine if they wanted, people in other countries would do anything to get the shot. Moment of silence marked the end of a two-week search for survivors at the site of partially collapsed condo building in Surfside, Florida. At midnight, the operation to locate victims shifted from rescue to recovery after authorities determined there was no chance of finding anyone alive in the rubble of the Champlain Tower South building. The confirmed death toll stands at 60. The Republican National Committee and National Republican Senatorial Committee are stepping in on behalf of Georgia to oppose the Department of Justice's lawsuit challenging the new voting law. WABE's Christopher Alston has details.
Republican leadership announced the decision to intervene today, calling the lawsuit politically motivated. The DOJ is suing the state under the Voting Rights Act, alleging the Republican-backed voting law signed in March is discriminatory against black Georgians. The Republican organizations filed a motion Tuesday to serve alongside Georgia as a defendant against the DOJ's lawsuit.
Christopher Alston reporting. The Dow closes down 259 points. You're listening to NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
Nestled alongside an otherwise ordinary house on Kodiak rests a shipping container. It seems a little out of place, but even more conspicuous is the garden inside of it. Bright Box Farms' growing area looks like a prop from a movie about space exploration. The vertically oriented hydroponic farm is its own perfect microclimate. Using the shipping container has enabled Gideon Saunders to conquer the seasons that otherwise rule Kodiak's gardens.
That's where we engaged with Freight Farms, who builds 40-foot containers, high cubes, 9.5 feet tall, 8 feet wide, standard container, just a little taller, very insulated, highly insulated, R28. And then, you know, so we engaged with them and spec'd out a unit and then had it shipped to us.
Freight Farms made the interior of the shipping container. Inside are hanging racks of lettuce and other greens, interspersed with panels of blindingly bright ultraviolet lights. A panel filled with nutrients feeds into a water tank at the back, which in turn drip feeds into the hydroponic system. The air is supplemented with a carbon dioxide tank, ensuring that the plants want for nothing. The container is controlled entirely by app, and it even comes with Bluetooth speakers built in. But it's a function over form for this container. Saunders boasts that with less than 30 hours of work, he could grow 1,000 heads of lettuce per week. It's not just that it seems futuristic. Saunders is convinced that systems such as this will revolutionize farming.
I think it's the future. I mean, we can get into the politics of farming and the water rights and fresh water usage globally and global warming and all these hot button topics. 8 billion, 9 billion, 10 billion people, how do you feed them? Population's growing, you know, how do you get more efficient with your food? Well, when it comes to produce and leafy greens and what we're doing, we use 95% less water than traditional farming. We don't use herbicides, pesticides, or insecticides. So, you know, no glyphosate, no Miracle-Gro, no, you know, nothing bad chemically. You can control it. So it's the future of farming.
This sort of production doesn't come cheap. Saunders says the unit cost around $100,000 with shipping and handling. But as the march of technological process inevitably pushes prices down, it will become more cost-effective for small farmers to invest in equipment like this. And Saunders says it already is cost-effective for him, although his container is supplemented with a small homemade grow in his garage. He sells microgreens by way of subscription service, in which he provides bags of greens to subscribers on a weekly basis for a monthly fee, and by sales at the local farmer's market. Even on an island known for its challenges to gardening and commercial shipping, herbivores can still enjoy fresh, locally produced produce all year long. This year's state budget, which went into effect July 1st, does not include funding for the Power Cost Equalization Program. Power Cost Equalization, or PCE, lowers the cost of electricity in rural Alaska to make it comparable to more urban areas like Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Juneau. KYUK's Greg Kim reports on what residents in rural Alaska can expect in their next utility bill.
The Alaska Village Electric Cooperative delivers electricity to 58 communities in rural Alaska, 20 of which are in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. All of them rely on PCE. AVIC CEO Bill Stamm said that without PCE credits, the cost of electricity for those residents will shoot up.
It's probably going to be the difference of about $100 a month for those accounts on average. It's going to be a substantial jump.
To break it down further, he said AVIC customers in YK Delta villages could expect their electricity bills to double, while bills in Bethel would go up about one-fourth. That's because fuel prices in Bethel are cheaper than in the villages. Stamm says higher electricity costs have a trickle-down effect on other utilities as well. He says water plants and sewer treatment centers use large amounts of energy to operate.
That is going to put a huge pinch on community facilities that are anticipating a much lower electrical cost to keep their water and sewer running. Those systems might start getting shut down fairly quickly if they realize they can't afford to pay the electrical bill.
Stamm could not definitively say whether customers' electricity bills for July will reflect the higher prices without PCE credits. He said AVIC's billing system is not set up to charge customers without PCE credits, but he said the company is currently working on making that change.
Whether we'll be able to accomplish that by the time we would typically send out our July billing in early August is in question.
Stam says the best advice he has for his customers is to prepare for the worst.
Brace yourself. Rates can be going up. Don't count on PCE being available until the legislature acts.
The next legislative special session is scheduled to begin on August 2nd. Stam said if state legislators vote to fund PCE later in the year, AVEC would reimburse its customers for previous months of PCE credit. In Bethel, I'm Greg Kim.
Firefighters on the Munson Creek wildfire near Chena Hot Springs are taking advantage of cool, wet weather to make progress towards stopping the blaze. Over 100 people are battling the more than 25,000-acre fire.
You know, working long days, and they're gonna get after it here while they can.
State Forestry spokesperson Tim Mowry says the weather is allowing direct attack on the fire's perimeter around the Chena Hot Springs Resort and along Chena Hot Springs Road. But he stresses it's still tough going.
It's not a square by any means. It's a blob with fingers, you know, extending out in different directions. And some of the terrain is very steep, and it is really difficult to put any line there. And the fire is big enough now, you're not going to put a line around that whole fire.
Mowry says work is also progressing on the installation of pumps, hose, and sprinklers to protect structures along the road and the Chena River.
They set everything up, get it in place. They'll go back and test it every few days to make sure that everything's functioning properly. And if the fire does come down that hillside and threaten those cabins, they just go in, they turn on the sprinklers, the pumps, and it just wets down the whole area.
Mowry said 72 structures, everything from outhouses to homes, had been set up with the sprinklers as of Tuesday. He says the Munson Creek fire is expected to revive next week when warm, dry weather is forecast to return. An evacuation order remains in effect from the Chena Hot Springs Road, mile 45 east. All state park facilities in that area are closed, but the Chena Hot Springs Resort continues to operate. Some of Alaska's most valuable pollinators are bumblebees, and it turns out we have a lot of them. As bumblebees have been declining in parts of the lower 48, they're apparently thriving in Alaska, even in the high Arctic. Now, a project to compile an Alaska bee atlas aims to give us a better understanding of how many bees there really are in Alaska, including the bumbles, which belong to the genus Bombus. Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor and writer at Atlas Obscura and wrote about Alaska's bumblebees in a recent article. Tarlak is also a beekeeper, and she told Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove that while honeybees are also pollinators, the native bumblebees are particularly important to the ecosystem.
Bumblebees have evolved to pollinate specific plants. So without bumblebees around, or without other kinds of bee specialists around, those plants will not reproduce. So even though we think of honeybees as useful, they're useful to us as humans in addition to the plants they pollinate, but bumblebees and other bee species are extremely important for healthy ecosystems.
And bumblebees do pretty well in Alaska still. How is that? Why do bumblebees do well in such a northern latitude?
They really evolved to handle the cold better than most insects. One of the folks I talked to said, you know, bumblebees are really pushing the envelope of what insects can do. And the reason they're doing really well in Alaska is down to a few different things. Number one, bumblebees, again, cold adapted. Their life cycle includes a queen that will hibernate alone underground for 8 to 9, maybe even 10 months out of the year. Bumblebees are also larger so that they have more mass and can keep themselves warm, and they are really good at twerking. I know that sounds crazy, but bees in general can detach their flight muscles from their wings and then just vibrate their flight muscles. So it's basically, you know, just doing this really intense vibrating wiggle that generates warmth. And bumblebees are super good at this. They can actually raise their temperature by 30 degrees in about 5 minutes just by vibrating these flight muscles.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. So are they kind of like warm-blooded in a way, or so like pseudo warm-blooded? How would you describe that?
You know, it's funny. I was talking to Derek Sykes from the University of Alaska Museum. He's the curator of the insect collection there. And he very casually mentioned that bumblebees are warm-blooded. And I said, wait, stop, hold the phone. What? And he said, yeah, you know, they do not generate heat constantly the way mammals do, but they do generate heat internally. So technically, bumblebees are warm-blooded. And there's some evidence as well that some species will just sit on specific flowers. For example, Bombus polaris, which is the Arctic bumblebee, it likes to sit on poppies. It's not collecting nectar or pollen. It's just sitting on the poppy because the poppy's shape reflects sunlight really well. So it actually helps the bee warm itself better than other flowers.
There's this Bee Atlas project, right? What is that?
Researchers and land managers are finally going to be able to get a sense of just how many bees, specifically bumblebees too, are in Alaska. And that's really important for a number of reasons. I mean, it's a signal of good ecosystems, ecosystem health. It's important to understand if the bees are doing well in the face of climate change and other changes to their habitat. And it's also just really cool because there's so many areas that haven't been surveyed. There were probably even more bumble species in Alaska that no one has found yet.
And our current thinking right now is that bumblebees are doing pretty well in Alaska, right?
Yeah, bumblebees are doing really well in Alaska by all the information that folks have so far. And unfortunately, that is not the case in the lower 48 in a lot of areas, specifically some species like Bombus franklini or Bombus occidentalis, the western bumblebee. They have disappeared from huge portions of their natural ranges. Climate change is a big factor. There are other factors as well, including the way we use the land, especially with monoculture agriculture, growing one crop and not allowing any room for wildflowers or other plants that the bumblebees may forage on. But climate change is a big factor because there's already a lot of evidence showing bumblebees are moving north and they are moving up in elevation to cooler areas because they just can't handle the heat.
Alaska ranks near the bottom in children's economic well-being, according to new data from the Annie E. Casey Kids Count Program. Alaska fell to 47th this year, down from 34th in 2020. The state was 49th in education, the same as last year. Trevor Storrs is president and CEO of Alaska Children's Trust, an organization focused on supporting children's well-being. Alaska Children's Trust provides detailed Alaska-specific data for the Kids Count program. Storrs says dwindling state investment in children partly explains Alaska's low rankings. Alaska Children's Trust published a children's budget report last year, which looked at the state's investment over time.
And we saw that over the past 10 years that our investment in children and family has dropped by nearly 13%, which is a $400 million loss of funding towards children and families.
Storrs says for over a decade, Alaska has consistently ranked in the bottom half of all states in several indicators of children's well-being.
What it's really showing is that we're staying stagnant, that other states are really advancing and looking at this data and really strategizing and investing in the future of the next generation, whereas Alaska, we know, is actually not.
Storrs says the data should shape conversations about how the state is supporting children and families. He also says advocating for policies like ensuring children have health insurance and are meeting educational proficiency goals can help improve Alaska's standings.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Do fishermen think Alaska's harbors are clean or dirty? A survey aims to find out. More after this.
The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute works to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. Learn more at alaskaseafood.org.
Alaska has 90 ports along its rivers and marine waterways, from tiny to huge, according to the World Port Source. Thousands of fishermen and other mariners rely on ports and harbors to help maintain their livelihoods. But how do they feel about their care and maintenance? A new project aims to find out.
So it's kind of gauging how clean people think the harbors are and why they are that way and how we can make them cleaner.
Tav Amu is an Alaska Sea Grant Fellow who also skippers a salmon fishing boat at Bristol Bay. He's created an iPad project to survey fishermen's perceptions over pollution and waste during his downtime at the docks this summer in Dillingham. He'll then repeat the survey at Ninilchik on the Kenai Peninsula in the fall.
So how polluted it is and why, and then how we can address it. And so part of it is to go at commercial fishermen or boaters who use the harbor and see, like, do you think it's dirty and why?
Amu told KDLG he became interested in water quality and conservation while serving in the Navy.
I did not feel that there was enough attention toward cleanliness and sustainability and conservation. And so I got a master's in marine systems and policies, and the hope is to kind of bridge the gap between me who fishes and science or policymakers.
Amu's goal is to get baseline data on how people in the fishing community perceive harbor cleanliness and water quality. He'll then turn the survey results into a report and share it at the Harbor Master Forum in Anchorage in October. While there, he also hopes to help brainstorm new ways to clean up Alaska's waterways and create more awareness to reduce pollution. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods, serving Alaska's fishing communities since 1910. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement Number 15, date issued 9 a.m. on July 8th. There will be a 24-hour extension to the current commercial salmon fishing period from 9 p.m. Friday, July 9th, until 9 p.m. Saturday, July 10th in the following areas. In the Cape Alatak, Humpy Dead Man, Alatak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alatak District. The inner and outer upper station sections of the Alatak District will close to commercial salmon fishing at 9 p.m. Saturday, July 10th. Closed waters are currently reduced until 9 p.m. Saturday, July 10th, in the inner upper station section of the Alatak District, and waters will remain open to the stream terminus at Olga Creek, stream number 257304. As previously announced, the following areas will close to commercial salmon fishing at 9 p.m. Thursday, July 8th. The inner Iqaluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District and the Mainland District. Closed waters are increased until 9 p.m. Thursday, July 8th in the inner Iqaluk section and includes those waters within 500 yards of the stream terminus Iqaluk River, stream number 256201. As previously announced, the following areas will close to commercial salmon fishing at 9 p.m. Friday, July 9th. The Northwest Kodiak District, except for the Kujuyak Bay section, remains closed. The Northeast Kodiak District, except for the Buskin River section, remains closed. The Eastside Kodiak District, except for the Inner Yukgak Bay section, remains closed. And the Afognak District, except for the Duck Bay, Izuit Bay, and Inner and Outer Katoy Bay sections, remain closed. The Fowl Bay Special Harvest Area and the Waterfall Bay Special Harvest Area. The Outer Iqaluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District will remain open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice. Closed waters are currently reduced until 9 p.m. Thursday, July 9th, in Fowl Bay to the stream terminus of Hidden Lake Creek, stream number 251406, and in Waterfall Bay to the stream terminus of Little Waterfall Creek, stream number 251822, and to the stream terminus of Big Waterfall Creek, stream number 251821. Until further notice, in that portion of the northwest and southwest Kodiak District south of the latitude of Cape Kuliak, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Concerning the North Shelikof Strait fishery, short notice in-period closures may occur for seine fisheries in the seaward zones of the North Shelikof Strait area as designated in the North Shelikof Strait Sockeye Salmon Management Plan. Closure announcements may occur at 8:30 a.m., 10 a.m., noon, 2 p.m., 5 p.m., or 8 p.m. on VHF Channel 6. Cost recovery fisheries have begun in Spirit and Bay Special Harvest Area, and Spirit and Bay Special Harvest Area will remain closed to common property fishing. Fishery opportunities will depend on the ability to meet KRAA cost recovery needs, and all cost recovery information may be obtained by calling 486-6559. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak Area Salmon Statistical Chart and detailed in Commercial Salmon Fishing Regulations and Statistical Charts. Harvest strategies and Commercial Salmon Fishing Regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office. And, of course, most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recorder phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Good afternoon, and welcome to your Island Messenger for Thursday. It is the 8th day of July, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 5:22. It won't set again until 11:06. That will give us 17 hours and 44 minutes of daylight, a loss of 2 minutes and 23 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high for this day was 80, set in 2004, and our record low was 41, set in 1940. Currently 54 degrees. We're looking for a 60% chance of rain for the rest of the day, then just a chance of rain until before 11 p.m., then a slight chance of rain after 5 a.m. tonight. Mostly cloudy skies today and tomorrow. Southeast winds to 5, although they are currently clocking right out of the east at about 6. Rain is on the schedule for tomorrow, mainly after 11 a.m., high near 53 tomorrow. Those winds are expected to turn all the way around to the south and increase to 20 miles per hour tomorrow afternoon, could gust as high as 30. Rain for Friday night as well, with a low around 48, south wind to 20, gusting as high as 30. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide here on the east side coming up at 2:49 p.m. It will be a 6.3-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 7:38 p.m. of 3.1 feet. Over on the west side, and these are Zacher Bay tides, you have a high tide coming up at 2:58 p.m. of 12 feet. Your low tide will be at 8:32 p.m. and be 3.8 feet. Mariners, here's your forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanat, Kodiak's east side offshore. Small craft advisory for Friday. Variable 10 right now, seas to 4 feet. Southwest 15 tonight, seas remaining at 4 feet. For tomorrow, south winds increasing to 30 knots tomorrow afternoon, seas to 5 feet. Over in the Shelikof, small craft advisory for Friday as well. Southwest 15 right now in the Shelikof, seas to 3 feet. For tomorrow, south 30, seas building to 8 feet. And for Friday night in the Shelikof, southeast 20, seas coming back down to 5 feet. Nominating petitions for 1 2-year mayor seat and 2 3-year city council seats are available in the city clerk's office now. For additional information, call the city clerk at 486-8636. The Kodiak City Council will be holding a work session followed by a regular meeting tonight. That's happening at the Kodiak Public Library Multipurpose Room. The work session is expected to begin at 6:30 p.m., and the regular meeting at 7:30. Both will be broadcast here on KMXT on 100.1 FM and are open to the public. The web streaming link, agendas, and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak website. And again, for more information, call the city clerk at 486-8636. Join the Kodiak Public Library in welcoming former Kodiak resident Ken Reinke to the island after recently completing his transcontinental bike ride across the entire United States. He will be making a presentation about his ride on Saturday, July 10th. That's happening at 12 p.m. in the library's multipurpose room. If you have been recently vaccinated or plan to be vaccinated soon, there may be a $50 gift card in your future. If you've been vaccinated since June 15th, just go to the Kodiak Baptist Mission at 1944 East Rezanoff Drive, present your vaccination card, and they will present you with a $50 gift card to one of several local businesses. So again, If you were vaccinated since the 15th, just bring your card into the Kodiak Baptist Mission office during working hours. They're off during lunch. For more information, call 486-4126.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.